So thank you, and thank you for the organizers of this meeting to give me this opportunity to speak about this. This will be a survey talk about a number of papers and work I've been doing in the last, say, 1 year and a half or 2 years. And you see people, names of people with whom I have some joint papers. So this is, I think, two or three papers. Ilesz Horváth and Bálint Vete, the first and the last one, are PhD students in Budapest. By the way, Bálint Vete is defending his PhD in a few months from now. And Pierre Tarres is in Oxford, he's a French colleague, and Benedek is sitting here somewhere, I think, from Navizom. Good. So this is scaling limits for self-interacting random walks and diffusions. And let me, I'm not very... Right. So let me just sort of define what I'm speaking about. There will be a number of models which have some sort of similar flavor, but I will give you three different formulations because they have different origins and actually two different formulations of different origins. You will see some history later. So one is this true self-avoiding random walk, and I don't ask you why true. I tell you why it's called true. It's not a good name. People don't like this name, and for good reason, because the true doesn't refer to the truly self being it truly self-avoiding, but to being it truly a walk. So as opposed to the what we call self-avoiding walk is not random walk, is not a process in time, but it's a sequence of polymer measures. This is a process in time. So, and the name is given by, I will give you some references. So in the first paper, physics paper, it appeared on that, and this name, maybe it's better to call it myopic. Anyway, so it's about the following. This is a discrete time random walk on the d-dimensional integer lattice. I denote by L, N, and X its local time, that means occupation time measure, or local time on sites, except that I left some initial values. So that for some reasons you will see later, I allow for some initial values of the local time, but essentially what you see here is the number of visits at site X up to time N by this discrete time walk. So the increments of this increments in time will be indeed the same as the increments of the local time on site. Now pick your favorite rate function W, which in the original physics paper I will give reference to was chosen as e to the minus e increasing e to the beta X, but it could be anything increasing or non-decreasing and non-constant. And now here I give you the law of the walk, which is the following. This Fn denotes everything you know about the past of the walk, so the sigma algebra of the past, and the conditional distribution of the next step, its nearest neighbor, first of all, and the conditional distribution of the next step, conditional probability of the next step being one of the neighbors, will be proportional of W, this increasing function, taken at the increment, at the discrete gradient between, okay, this is negative gradient actually, negative gradient between the actual position and the target position, right? So it's jumping, if it has to choose between neighbors, it prefers to choose that neighbor which was less visited in the past. Good, I have to learn how to, that's it. And here you see a continuous time version, very little, slightly different. So I will run fast through this, which is still a random walk. Actually, it's a jump process. It's a continuous time walk on the same discrete, on the same lattice, continuous time. But now you record the time, that means continuous time spent on lattice sites with initialization, and instead of probabilities, we will have, of course, jump rates. Pick your favorite non-negative rate function, which is assumed to be, okay, I assume a little bit less than increasing, you will see what. Anyway, it's assumed to be strictly positive, so be bigger than a strictly positive constant, which is something we know as uniform ellipticity, condition, and what I assume here is only that its odd part be increasing or non-decreasing. I don't assume that about the even part. And now the law is very, very similar. The jump rates, the random walker can jump to one of its neighbors, and the jump rate will be proportional to the negative, to W taken at this negative gradient. And let me do something else now, a continuous space-time version. As you will see, maybe at first, it's not clear that it's very similar, but it will be. Namely, this is a continuous. I'm sorry. I'm not good at. Where is the red dot? So here it is. Okay. So this is a sort of diffusion in RD now, not diffusion in the sense of being a continuous path process on RD, for which now the local time is defined as occupation time measure for any, say, A is an open set in RD, then this is essentially the occupation time measure of this process, the time spent in the set A, except that, again, I allow some initial measure with some regularity. I will be more specific about assumption, about technical assumptions later. And now I define, I need some self-interaction, some function which will define the self-interaction. This will be, this V is a kind of approximate identity, approximate delta function. I assume it be infinitely differentiable, decay sufficiently fast at infinity, be spherically symmetric. It's not a very important assumption. Better we make it spherically symmetric. And what's a very important assumption, I'm simply unable to use this. So what is a very important assumption, that's why it's denoted, so this tag is in red, is that I assume that it is of positive type. So this function B of positive type has positive, non-negative Fourier transform, and better you think about a concrete example than about abstract, so e to the minus x squared is perfectly good. And the driving force, you will see in what sense, is the negative gradient of this function, V. And now the law of the process is written in three different ways, but it's the same. I prefer to point to the last line which gives it in terms as a stochastic differential equation, namely dxt. You have the randomness, you have the noise, the Brownian noise driving it, but the instantaneous drift is okay. Do the following: take this occupation time measure, which is a singular object. You cannot take derivative of it. I want to push it in towards the derivative, the gradient or negative gradient of the local time. But instead of doing that, I have to smear out. So I smear out by convoluting with this approximate identity. Then I have a smooth random field, and take the gradient of this smooth random field at the actual position of the random walker, right? Which, okay, in all these cases, you see what's written here, namely that the phenomenon is somewhat similar. The walk or this process is pushed by the negative gradient of occupation time measure. So it's pushed towards locations less visited in the past. And now here you see some history of the problems. The self-avoiding, so the discrete space-time problem, was first formulated in this by now quite famous paper by Daniel Amit, Giorgio Parisi, and Luca Pelliti in 1983 in Physical Reviews. And there were a number of papers in the 80s, mostly physics papers. So there are some mathematical ideas, but these are mostly physics papers. I will speak more about them. So these are all about the self-avoiding walk problem. And sometime not long later, in the probabilistic community, appeared a series of papers and the problems formulated, which refer to this, what I call SRBP, stands for the continuous space-time process, right? And the first, okay, there was this paper by Norris, Rogers, and Williams. It's not quite this, but I like sort of the paper in which this sort of self-repelling polymer model appeared is this one by Durrett and Rogers in 1992, and many more papers. In particular, you don't see all of them here. I will prefer. So there is a recent paper by Mountford and Torres, where also survey of the problem can be found. So I recommend. I unfortunately didn't write it here. Anyway, so these are the roots, and let's go on. Here are some conjectures which are mainly taken from the physics papers and are based on renormalization group arguments or scaling arguments, which are convincing, though by no means rigorous, and I have to admit that I don't really understand all steps, but these renormalization group arguments typically are some, so lead to conjectures which are worth taking seriously. So the conjectures were formulated in those, and the conjectures were formulated for the random walk, but if you look at the arguments, they can be, at that level of rigor, can be saved for the continuous spacetime as well. That in one dimension, you would expect time to the 2/3 scaling, xt is the displacement, so time to the 2/3 scaling with some intricate scaling limit, which is not, they don't say anything about that. In two and more, let's say in three and more dimensions, what they expect is diffusive scaling and Gaussian limit, that means Wiener processes limit, and in two dimensions, that would be the critical dimension of the problem. So what you see is just super diffusivity, just marginally super diffusive with logarithmic correction. And I always keep saying that, okay, this is one of the few cases when even in the physics literature you find controversy about the value of an exponent. If you look at those physics papers and many more, you will find different arguments for different values of this exponent zeta. And here are some results. Okay, this is just a fast survey of results. I'm not going to speak about what's in the background. The one-dimensional problem in some particular cases was solved. Okay, solved. Proved that the scaling limit in our probabilistic terms was proved in a paper of mine back in 1995, which was a particular version, and there is another paper more recent with my PhD student, which is another particular version. I emphasize that these are particular versions of the models, which and the proofs rely on combinatorial details. So that's why I write here that missing a fully robust proof, because you would think that there is a global, there is a universal behavior, and details wouldn't matter whether you take it first neighbor or next to or second neighbor jumps or whatever, that this shouldn't matter. But these proofs, what I refer here to, rely on these combinatorial details. In a later paper, we also, with Wendel Werner, a few years later, we constructed the limiting process. It's not the case that we proved convergence, process-wise convergence. Actually, convergence of multidimensional marginal distributions from the method of that paper drop out. I proved only one-dimensional marginals, but in this paper we constructed the what would be the scaling limit. I'm not going to speak about this. So this what is not today called Brownian web was done in that paper and used. And in a more recent paper, joint with Benedek and with Pierre, we took a general class of these. Of the continuous space-time, one-dimensional continuous space-time, and we prove bounds on the limiting variance. I just claim here one of them for the particular self-repelling mechanism, but what we did is more general type of self-interaction and some more general type of bounds. I'm not going to speak about this. What I want really to emphasize that in one dimension, of course, this enters into this class of models which scale like time to the 2/3, but a fully robust proof in the sense that an analytic proof, which relies only on the phenomena and not on the combinatorial details, is still missing, and it would be nice to have some. And here are more recent ones, more recent results about the higher dimension. This is what I want to give some details of, are the following. Let me jump to the three-dimensional first. With Ilesz Horváth and Bálint Vető, recently we proved diffusive. Indeed, this not exactly the conjecture. I will give the precise conditions later, But in some sense, we proved this, the high dimensional claim, namely that in high dimensions, three and more dimensions, the process scaled diffusively converges to standard normal or multidimensional versions of this. I will give more. I will be more precise about formulation of the conditions. So this paper, this is just recently we got positive reports about it and will be published, I hope, soon. And in two dimensions with Benedek, we worked on this for some time and applying methods which I will quote later, methods by Landin, Quastel, Zamhofer, Riau, we were able to prove at least logarithmic corrections, not the true order. You see, there is a huge gap here between the lower bound and the upper bound, but we have some, at least we prove the marginal, marginal in the sense that just super diffusivity. So that much about introduction and what's expected and what's done. And now I give you some details, and I formulate my details in terms of the continuous space-time process because it's a bit easier to formulate and less technical than the lattice, but I will tell you the exact statements later. Fine. First of all, the way of approaching this type of problems is the natural way of approaching is that you travel with a random walker and you follow the environment as seen from the random walker. Now the environment is what? The environment is the local time profile. The local time profile better you look at the gradient of the local time. In this sense, smear out the local time and take the gradient. This will be a random field changing in time, even if you look from outside. You don't travel with the random walker. This changes in time because the random walker as walks around, local time changes, increases, and due to that, the gradient of the local time changes. So this is a dynamical random environment. But on top of that it changes as looking from outside. I put my origin at the position of the actual position of the random walker. So actually changes for two reasons, namely due to increase of local time and due to shift by motion of the random walker. Now, if you look at this is a random field. This is a random vector field, and this yes, there is a remark. There is a difference between one and two, respectively three and more dimensions. We'll see later that in one and two dimension you must look at the gradient. Otherwise, you don't see something tight. In three and more dimensions, you could do due to the transience of the random walk, you could just look at the local time without taking a gradient, and that the formulas are simple. Good, but better we do it this way because I want to speak about two dimensions as well. Now, put yourself. It turns out that this process will be a Markov process with continuous sample paths in a huge space, in a function space. The function space will be the space of gradient fields, smooth gradient fields, with some natural seminorms. The natural seminorms, okay, formulas are always scary, but this means that the field themselves and all its partial derivatives increase slower than any power of the distance. Right? And this space is a treatment, so topologically easy to understand space. And eta t, so the process itself we are looking at, is Markov in this. Now, if you think about the lattice, it's easy to see this, because once I give you the local times or the gradients of the local times everywhere, futures will be clearly determined by the actual position. And in order to understand the process, of course, we have to understand the infinitesimal generator. We have to understand what happens in infinitesimal time. So what I do is the following. Go to this space, so all the functions we are looking at are functions or functionals over this function space. So I will have to define some operators acting on functions defined on this omega. And the functions defined on this omega, the test functions will be functions which depend on finitely many values of the field or its partial derivatives. This will be the basic test functions. And it's easy to define some operators on, that's what I call smooth cylinder functions. In particular, there is a gradient operator, there is a Laplacian operator, and there is something what is typically called directional derivative operator. But mind that these operators, the gradient Laplacian, are operators acting on functions over omega, so these are not gradient down on RD, right? It's clear that you have a shift, so on omega there is a shift acting. So once a shift is acting there, spatial shift, you can define the gradient operators, right? And that's on the first line. On the second line, you see what I call a Laplacian. And on the third line, that's a bit different of this. This is defined in terms of infinitesimal change due to local time increasing, local time going on, right? So your functions change a little because as time goes on, you add a little bit of local time where you are, actually smoothed out. And we are looking at the gradient of that, so we have to care about, we have to care about how this acts on functions, and that's a natural thing to do. And you check that these are indeed defined on smooth cylinder functions, and if you look at what happens with your process, you can write down, question? Francis? No? You can write down the infinitesimal generator, and you can understand what happens here. So this part of the infinitesimal generator is due to the Brownian shift. This part of the infinitesimal generator is due to the deterministic part of the shift, namely that there is a push. Omega zero is the vector, is gradient of the local time at the actual position. So that's due to this. And the last bit is due to the increase of local time. So this is very easy to understand in terms of these operators. Good? And what happens is that, and what is a big luck indeed, that by some, what I call a miracle, of course it's not, okay, it's a miracle in some sense, that in these huge vectors, in this huge space, we are able to identify a stationary measure for this process. And it turns out that the stationary measure of this process, a stationary measure of this process, will be essentially, what you see here is essentially the gradient of the massless free Gaussian field. Of course, massless free Gaussian field in D in any dimension is not, okay, indeed greater than 2 or greater, is a generalized process. So but it's regular, it's smoothed out. So take the massless free Gaussian field, that's a generalized field of stationary increment. Smear it out by this V. I'm sorry, not by V, but by square root of V in the sense of of Fourier transform. And that's why we need V be of positive type. So take the unique, or take square root of Fourier transform of V, that will be a Fourier transform of another nice function, right? And smear out the massless free Gaussian field by that, and take the gradient of this object, right? Now this will be stationary. This measure, this defines the measure, a probability measure on omega, and this will be stationary for our process. And okay, once you guess it, it's not so difficult to prove. So it's not difficult to prove. There are two proofs, actually. One going through Itô calculus, and the other one through functional analysis. And I don't know how I stand with time. Maybe I jump. I just skip some slides because. So here you see a sketchy proof by Itô through Itô calculus why this is true, what I claim. But I skip that. And here is a remark, okay, but I still have time to go to give a remark for the lattice model because that's a bit, so the lattice model is also interesting and it's a bit different. But just very, very fast remarks about that. So far I spoke about the continuous space-time model. Now let's go to the continuous time but lattice model. And if you do exactly the same type of story and you try to find a stationary measure for the process, then what you will see is the following. Let's be in three and more dimensions so that, that omega is not the gradient but the field itself, because it's easier, the formulas are easier. So let's put ourselves in three and more dimensions. Then you can define a Gibbs measure in the following way. So omega is a scalar field on lattice sides, and r, mind that I denoted by lowercase r, I'm sorry, I denoted by lowercase r the odd part of the interaction function. Capital R will be the primitive or the integral function of this, which will be an even function, right? And define a Gibbs measure in this term. So it's a Gibbs measure, it's a gradient field. It's defined in terms of gradients. And in three and more dimensions, it turns out because lowercase r is increasing, this capital R is a convex function, so this will define, in three and more dimensions, it will define a measure, a Gibbs measure on scalar fields, and that will be the stationary measure. Okay, but I'm not going to speak more about this now. And let's go back now to the continuous space-time model. So far, we had omega, and we identified pi, which was the stationary measure, which was this Gaussian measure over omega, and which was the stationary measure for our process. And once we have this, of course, we put ourselves in the Hilbert space, in the L2 space, which being a Gaussian, okay, over a Gaussian measure, so Hilbert space over a Gaussian probability measure, it will be a beautifully graded Hilbert space, where on Hn contains, the subspace Hn contains, say, the generalized nth degree Hermite polynomials on the fields or any of its gradients, of its partial derivatives, right? So, okay, you may call this, I call it Fock space, but probably most of you would call it Wiener chaos decomposition. And now if we go back, mind that there was an infinitesimal generator defined in, but that was in very natural terms defined for these test functions, right? But now we are in the L2 space, we are in this L2 space, and in this L2 space those operators have some very special form of writing them. Using, okay, creation and annihilation operators are needed, so this sort of quantum field theory terminology, but the operators are those ones which I defined already. But in this L2 space, using what is the creation operator? The creation operator A sub L starred maps Hn into Hn plus 1 in the following way, that if you take a weak monomial like that, nth order weak monomial, mind that the omegas are the fields. So these are jointly Gaussian. So weak monomial, make it a weak monomial 1 degree higher by adding omega at zero, and mind that omega is a vector field, the lth component of omega at zero. Right? And the annihilation operator will be just the adjoint of this, easy to compute. And if you do all that, then your infinitesimal generator gets a particular attractive, beautiful form in this space. The proof is careful analysis. Once you understand these operators, you have to carefully use them, and use one more thing, which in Mariaven calculus is called directional derivative identity, but it's more or less straightforward once you are familiar, once you understand what happens. So at this moment, we do have the L2 space, and we do have a very well understood, this is not formal, these operators are well understood operators, or that Hilbert space, a nice, beautiful form for the infinitesimal generator, right? And not only stationarity, here is another proof of stationarity, if you wish, not by Ito, but looking at this operator, write down the adjoint of the mind that this is This is, S is the symmetric part, and A plus A plus A minus is the skew symmetric or skew self-adjoint part of the infinitesimal generator. From this form, you see that its adjoint is again an infinitesimal generator. That's why, that's another proof, if you wish, of stationarity. But also ergodicity drops out from here, from these formulas. And now let's go back to the processes. Let's go back to the processes. Now, the displacement process, is written as a martingale plus an integral along the trajectory of this Markov process of a functional over the state space of the Markov process. The martingale happens to be just the Brownian motion in this case, right? It's clear that if you go back to the definition of the model, this is exactly what's written there in terms of stochastic differential equation, right? So what you need in order to prove either diffusivity in three dimensions or super diffusivity in two dimensions is to understand what these guys do, right? In order to prove diffusivity in three and more dimensions, this is a Brownian motion. You have to prove central limit theorem for this part and to check that the two altogether don't cancel, so they will give jointly a Brownian motion. It happens in some models that this type of writing, the second one cancels out the first one, and then you are unlucky, so that happens in, but not in our case. So that's one part, and if you want to prove something about that, this is typically the instance where this Kipnis-Varadhan theory can be applied. So you have a stationary Markov chain. By Kipnis-Varadhan theory, I need the generalized, so not, because the original Kipnis-Varadhan paper was for self-adjoint process, for reversible processes, but there are extensions. So that's what we actually do, a bit more than just applying directly Kipnis-Varadhan. We have to work a little bit more for that, improving some conditions and so do something with it. But that's the idea to apply. And indeed, that will rely, okay, I will give you some details. That's in three and more dimensions. And in two dimensions, we believe that super diffusivity holds, and that's what we want to prove. Of course, this M will not play much role in super diffusivity because this is a stationary, a martingale of stationary increment. But the super diffusivity must come from here. And there is this paper by Landim, Quaster, Zalmhofer, and Yao back in 2004, I think, where they give a general scheme of how to treat this type of problem. Actually, they apply it for tag particle diffusion in not tag particle, second class particle in asymmetric simple exclusion, but the general scheme seemingly applies well, right? Not again, it's not the case that you just take it from there, put it here, and the result drops out, but essentially the scheme is there. And here I now I'm ready to formulate the theorems in proper terms, so in a rigorous with conditions. And so in three and more dimensions the statement is the following, and let me just emphasize, all results stated are valid in the stationary regime. So that's why I started with initialization of the local time. And that's why I say that the conjectures are not really proved in the sense, because the original conjectures were, okay, start with empty, no local time, and go on. But I am able to apply all these methods, the Kipnis-Varadhan method or Landim-Quastel, etc. method, in the stationary regime. So I need initialization. And let me make two more comments about this here, that I think that in one and two dimensions, this is not a, okay, it's a different statement, but it's essentially what I didn't prove, and probably I will not be able to prove it, that these are essentially all the stationary measures. By the way, no, I have to make a regression of remarks. There are tilted stationary measures. I speak about non-tilted stationary measures. You could take the Gaussian okay, this gradient of Gaussian, free Gaussian field tilted, so at a constant vector, right? These will be against stationary measures, but these will impose a drift in the problem, which is interesting, but I'm not that much interested in that, because that the random walker is drifting away, memory is much shorter, in principle things are simpler. I don't see in technical level that I don't speak about that. I speak about the non-tilted initial conditions. That's one. Second, in one and two dimensions, due to recurrence, I think that these are the relevant stationary measures. In three and more dimensions, surely there are other relevant stationary measures. Imagine that if you start from empty initial condition, think about the lattice. Start from empty initial condition, let the walker go on. If indeed things happen as you expect, that it's transient, but it has a long memory, but it's transient, but then any stationary measure arising from the empty initial condition will not look like my stationary measure, because you will have sites around you which you have never visited, and my stationary measure is like a Gaussian free field, which is different. So in three and more dimensions, this is a natural class of stationary measures, but not the only interesting one. Right. Yes? In one dimension, I know everything. By the way, in one dimension, my original paper was, I know everything in the sense that for particular models with particular combinatorial details. But for those models, I know everything. So those theorems proved back in the 90s were not proved for stationary, were proved for zero initial conditions. In two dimensions, that's a question. Okay, I think if you start with zero, then till zero will be chosen, but I'm not able to. Okay, I think so. I think so, question?
Does what you were just saying, does that actually construct a different stationary measure in three dimensions? How do you actually manufacture a stationary measure from what you were just saying about following a particle from the empty state?
I have no idea.
I mean, that's not clear to me.
I have no idea how to do it, but clearly if you expect that starting from empty initial condition, you converge to some stationarity, that stationary measure must have, with positive probability, sites not visited. And the measure I put there doesn't have with probability one, it has a continuous distribution. So, but okay, let me go on and formulate and state the theorems. I speak about these stationary measures, right? And in these stationary measures, in three and more dimensions, first of all, the limiting variance does exist. The limit exists, it's not straightforward otherwise. So, okay, you have to work a little bit further. And the limiting, and there is a lower and upper bound, there is a lower and upper bound, so it exists and is non-degenerate, and mind that it matters here that Vp times 1 over p squared is integrable at zero. That's very important. We think about Vp as e to the minus x squared, right? So clearly, this holds only in three and more dimensions. And the main statement is that a central limit theorem for finite dimensional distribution, finite dimensional margins. Yes, this is a version for the lattice. The previous one was for the continuous space version. Lattice version is more tricky. The lattice version is more tricky, and we have to have more restrictions for the interaction functions. Let me skip this because time is shortened anyway. So with more restrictions on the functions used, interaction functions used in the lattice version, we also have the result. And the other result is a two-dimensional, which is done by Benedek and myself. Which says that in two dimensions, in the sense of Laplace transform, so don't take it very, very seriously, this take Laplace transform of these things you see here, and in sense of Laplace transforms, these inequalities hold. Right? Good. And now, a few words about the proofs. I already told you that in the diffusive case, we want to use the Kipnis-Faradan technology, and the so-called H minus bound. H minus bound sounds scary, that's actually an upper bound for the limiting variance. An upper bound from the limiting variance, which comes from the symmetric part of the infinitesimal generator, and that's needed, and the so-called graded sector condition, the graded sector condition, which is a condition, technical condition, for applicability of this martingale approximation of Kipnis and Varadhan, we have to work for that. We have to work for both. It's not just dropping out, but that's the essential thing. And proving the superdiffusive bound, there is this variational formula in this paper I already mentioned, but again I will come back to some particularities in the computational parts of the proof. And let me see how much time I have to choose one of the two, because my time is up. Yes, I skipped the diffusive part, so the sketchy sketch for the three and more dimensions. I skip this, and I go to the two dimensional. Now the two dimensional, so the where super diffusivity is proved. Probably I jumped over some slides. Anyway, just trust me that in order to prove, take the Laplace transform of this object here, right? If you take the Laplace transform of this object, then what you have to estimate is phi r lambda phi, where phi, mind that there was that function phi, which was a function from omega, an L2 function on omega p, on the lambda, right? And r lambda will be the resolvent of the infinitesimal generator in L2, in the Hilbert space, right? Then we go on. Here it is. Just I skipped some. So r lambda is the resolvent. R lambda is the resolvent. Of course, no way of computing r lambda. You have to estimate it. Okay, there is this variational problem, which is in that paper, but actually the first line of the variational problem is an easy, so okay, it's a homework for students learning Hilbert spaces, or geometry of Hilbert spaces. The second line is just the first line restricted on a subspace, so this is an identity. Take any positive, infinitesimal generator, take its resolvent, this is just an identity, it's easy to check, where S and A are the symmetric and skew symmetric part of the infinitesimal generator. Noting that the function this F is actually that phi. The function we are looking at, we want to find this bounds for this, lower bound for that, is in the graded Hilbert space, is in one of, in the lowest grade or lowest level of the graded Hilbert space. Better you try your infinitesimal variational formula in that subspace, which will give a lower bound, will not give an identity, will give a lower bound. And you find something, use the fact that your Hilbert space is graded and A has a raising part and a lowering part, and since you are restricting yourself to that Hilbert, that subspace, you have only this one, and these are explicit things. And actually what you see, there are three terms, and you have to find the supreme. We have to solve the variational problem in H1. Mind that H1 is actually isometric to L2 in RD, in R2. L2 in RD, am I correct? So you restrict I am correct. R2 in RD, but with some kernel function, not just R2, but the inner product is defined in terms of a kernel given by this e to the minus, given by this v, by this function. Anyway, so you are down to functions of one variable, and you formulate, so this is a variational problem, down to earth variational problem. And let me indeed, I have to go fast, and these formulas are just scary. Just what I want to show you that these have expressions, have explicit expressions. The first two are really almost trivial. I'm losing this red dot. Are almost trivial to understand, and this is the one which causes headache. Now, what is done in London, Quastel, Zamhof, Areau is estimating this term with a Schwarz inequality. Now, if you do exactly the same type of thing, then of course we are lost. We don't get anything, because this is a more, in a sense, it's computationally, it's in some point subtle. I will tell you in a moment why. So instead of that, we have to do some cut this integral into parts where p minus p and q are very close, and we see how close, and where p and q are away. And in this second part, in that second part, you can use Schwarz, and the first part you have to estimate this one by gradient. It's more computation, but we were able to do it. And let me just, this is the last of my slides, and let me just tell you that what makes this computation a bit more subtle, the computation I mean, this last one, is that the model is isotropic, as opposed to the tech particle or the second class particle problem in simple exclusion, which is not isotropic. In simple exclusion, asymmetric simple exclusion, you have in two dimensions, you have a direction chosen. It's not isotropic. And isotropy causes headache computationally. So it is a bit subtle that the isotropic model slightly less self-repellent than the non-isotropic one. And that's what causes here the headache, where we are hunting for a log-log instead for a log and computation. There are some differences. I think it's time to stop here. Thank you. Thank you.